The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful afternoon here at Edstone, and let's just say it's beautiful wherever you are as well. It's a beautiful time to listen in to the live stream, or as many of you do, to hear the podcast, which we post a few hours later at thetrumpet.com website and the kpcg.fm website as well. All of these podcasts, we're getting close to 1,000 of them now. I forget how close we are, but we're coming up on 1,000 programs, which is pretty amazing. Quick update here on the Glasgow personal appearance campaign scheduled for mid-March, just a month away now. At present, as I said yesterday, we sent out the invitations at the beginning of last week. So just the first round of letters, I think it went out to 500 or 600 trumpet readers. And so far we have 17 people registered for the Glasgow pack. So hopefully we'll see that number increase in the next several weeks. Well, on today's program, coming up in the second segment, we'll talk some about the Senate Intel Committee that released its, I don't know if it was a report or they just came out and said, look, after 2 years, after 200 interviews, we haven't discovered any collusion or conspiracy between President Trump and the Russians. And that's following the House Intel Committee's conclusion a while back as well. So the evidence, or the lack thereof, keeps pouring in. No collusion, nothing more than a witch hunt, as the president keeps saying. We'll get into that a little bit later on. And also toward the end of the show, and I think we'll have time for this, an article I'll refer you to that I know will make my wife happy, as she's constantly encouraging me to move more. It's easy having a desk job to sit far too often. And, we've even had articles at thetrumpet.com that have encouraged us to stand and to just get out and move and to exercise. I know Joel Hilliker has Jörg Mardian on his program occasionally, and he's written some articles for The Trumpet. So we'll point you to an article that does give some simple advice on just things that you can do throughout the day, even if you have a desk job, even if you do sit a lot, things that you can do throughout the day to just keep your body moving. Well, remember the Bo Bergdahl swap from 2014? That was just, 5 years ago, almost 5 years ago. He had abandoned his post in Afghanistan back in 2009. And the United States military, they unleashed this frantic manhunt to track him down. He could have been kidnapped or something. As it is, we found out later that he just deserted the American war effort and colluded with the enemy. That's what it amounted to. It says at thetrumpet.com, this was from June of 2014, several of his platoon mates have confirmed that he walked away from his post on that day in June 2009, intent on deserting. He even left a note saying he no longer supported the American effort in Afghanistan and had shipped many of his belongings home. But here's what I want you to think about. The United States, we got Bergdahl back in exchange for 5 senior Taliban commanders that were captured early on in the war against terrorism, and they were imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. I won't try to pronounce all of their names, but as we pointed out at the Trumpet, one of them was a top opium drug lord in Western Afghanistan. He helped found the Taliban, according to Human Rights Watch. And then one of them, Fazl, Muhammad Fazl, he oversaw the mass killing of Shiites in 2000 and 2001 as the Taliban solidified its control. That's from thetrumpet.com in June of 2014. So it made quite a lot of news, as there were people really on both sides, Democrats and Republicans alike, who were quite critical of the release of these five hardened terrorists. For one U.S. soldier, I think we lost maybe six soldiers trying to rescue Bergdahl, someone who deserted his post. But then to release five top Taliban commanders, listen to some of these clips on just how dangerous these individuals were and are to this day. This first one here is from Morning Joe, June 2014. They're interviewing this guy named Michael Leiter, the former director of the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center. Here's clip seven.
I do think that these five, who were really far on the far end of the spectrum of bad guys in Guantanamo, this is really problematic. For the long term, this is going to strengthen the Taliban. Our hand is obviously weakening there, and I think them going back is, listen, it's not going to turn the tide in Afghanistan. I think the tide has probably already turned, but it is strengthening them, and it is a big win for them.
A big win for the Taliban. That was MSNBC. This represents a big win for the Taliban. It's not going to turn it around for the United States, that's for sure. Our position, he was saying this in 2014, just how weak the American position was. Listen to CNN. Here's an interview with another advisor, Middle East advisor on Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is clip eight.
Their people and their forces, you know, these five were part of that role. Their people, their forces engaged in gross human rights violations. And as Jeremy pointed out, these are certainly very dangerous people. If they were to be released, the likelihood that they would return to the fight is high.
If they're released, the likelihood that they go right back to the battlefield, it's high. If you remember the terms of this deal, they had to stay in, what was it, Qatar, I believe, for a year before they could then be free to roam. That was back in 2014. MSNBC, CNN, these are dangerous terrorists. These are five of the worst that the Obama administration gave up. What a lopsided swap. An American deserter and five top Taliban chiefs. Five of them. Here's what the late Senator John McCain, here's what he said on Fox News, that same time period, clip nine.
These are the worst of the worst, the hardest of the hardest. Some of them are wanted for war crimes, responsible in at least one case for deaths of thousands of Shiite Muslims. They were judged and appraised at Guantanamo on a periodic basis, and each time unanimously viewed as such high risk that they could not be released or sent back to any other country. I can't tell you how dangerous these people are.
Every time their case was reviewed at Guantanamo, they were sent right back to their jail cell because of how dangerous they are. I can't tell you how dangerous these people are, said the late John McCain. And then his colleague in the Senate as well, Lindsey Graham, here's what he had to say, clip 10.
They're in military prison in Guantanamo Bay because they collaborated with al-Qaeda to attack the homeland. They were in charge of the Taliban government. They were senior Taliban officials before 9/11. That's the reason they're in jail, and they're going back to the fight just as sure as night follows day. This makes absolutely no sense.
No sense. And yet that's the... Well, that's what President Obama was doing for a number of years. Lopsided, he did it again with Iran, with the JCPOA, there in early 2016. This was a swap in 2014. Now, you fast forward to today, we've talked in recent weeks, I think it was at the end of January, the United States and the negotiations now that they're engaged in with the Taliban, to to negotiate America's retreat. And remember the Taliban stronghold in Afghanistan, particularly the eastern half, providing safe haven for Osama bin Laden, for Al-Qaeda. And so now we're at the negotiating table with this terrorist organization. And going by the New York Times, I read this piece from 2 weeks ago, there has been a breakthrough in negotiations now. And it's basically, we'll leave, that's America saying, we'll leave so long as you promise not to to use your territory, your region, your nation as a staging ground for terrorist acts. Those are essentially the terms. Now, as I said on that program a couple weeks ago, initially we went into Afghanistan to defeat the Taliban, to crush the forces of terrorism. But you look at that group today, they control more territory today than they did at the start of the war against terrorism. They hold more territory in Afghanistan than they have at any time in the past 20 years. And that's why we're having to negotiate with them. They're the top dog. They're in the driver's seat. And then you look at the United States. Look at our position. That New York Times article that I read from a couple weeks ago, it says, to many analysts of the Afghanistan conflict, the details that have emerged so far in discussions with the Taliban suggested an American desperation for a withdrawal from a war regarded as unwinnable. We're desperate to get out because we cannot win this. We can't win. And here we've had an 18-year presence in the country. 18 years. And we've spent nearly $1 trillion in just Afghanistan alone. And we've sacrificed the lives of nearly 2,000 American soldiers. Six of them in a failed rescue attempt for Bo Bergdahl. 2,000 soldiers, and now here we are sitting at the negotiating table, trying to agree on terms for peace in Afghanistan. Just recently, the Taliban named their negotiating team, and would you believe it? That five of their negotiators, their peace negotiators, are those same five that we swapped for Bo Bergdahl in 2014. Al Jazeera reported yesterday the Taliban has named a 14-member team of negotiators, including five former Guantanamo Bay inmates and a high-profile jailed leader, for the second round of talks with the United States. So it goes from bad to worse. You can go back and listen to the January 29th program where I went through that New York Times piece about the breakthrough in the first phase of negotiations. Now we're into the second phase, and they've named their dream team. The Taliban names their dream team of negotiators, five of them these top Taliban chiefs that were locked in Guantanamo. Dangerous criminals, hardened terrorists. What was it John McCain said? I can't even tell you how dangerous these people are. It says, Shir Muhammad Abbas Stanixi will head the team, which includes five former inmates of the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, who were released in 2014 in exchange for U.S. Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, captured by the Taliban in 2009 after wandering off base. Well, that's sugarcoating it somewhat. He didn't just wander off base. He deserted his post. And now here are American negotiators, desperate for a withdrawal. President Trump, desperate for a withdrawal from a country that they see as, well, what can we win here? What can we gain by staying here? This is unwinnable. But But can you believe that now we're negotiating with these five terrorists that used to be in U.S. custody? This represents an unmitigated defeat for the United States of America. This is worse than spending your strength in vain, like it's prophesied in Leviticus 26. This is a shameful defeat. And it's like the Taliban is taunting the United States. And they're even insisting that the U.S. release another terrorist. He's in jail in Kabul, but they're insisting that he be released. I forget his name. But before they even get on with this second round, this second phase of negotiations, they've got to have more terrorists freed. So who's negotiating here from the position of strength? And what kind of terms, seriously, if the United States, the world's, supposedly the world's sole superpower, if the U.S. says, we'll leave, we'll withdraw, so long as you promise not to sponsor any more terrorism from your country. What an embarrassment. What a shameful defeat. You won't hear anything about it, by the way. You won't hear anything about it in the news today. They're so obsessed. Their only enemy is the president. And yet look at what's happening to the United States abroad. Look at what's happening to the U.S. position in the Middle East and elsewhere. How can you view this in any other way other than a total unmitigated defeat, an embarrassing defeat, a shameful defeat? What a victory this represents for the Taliban. What a victory this represents for radical Islam. Do you think the rest of the nations in the region are watching? Do they see what's happening? Does Iran see what's happening? Or Saudi Arabia or Israel or Syria? The Taliban saying, all right, we can proceed to round two if you release one more terrorist. And, oh, by the way, five of our negotiators are the ones you let out of Gitmo. It just goes from bad to worse. This guy that they want released from Kabul, he's the younger brother of the leader of the Haqqani network. He's in an Afghanistan jail. And his older brother heads up the Haqqani network. These are some of the bloodiest and most violent jihadis in the region. Osama bin Laden himself camped out with them in the mountains. That leader of the Haqqani network, he's got a $5 million bounty on his head. Oh, and guess which terrorist group is responsible for kidnapping Bo Bergdahl? That would be the Haqqani network. It's all connected, isn't it? You go back and look at what we said at the start of the war against terrorism. Go back and look at what we said at that prisoner swap in 2014. Here, the Haqqani network is basically calling the shots. What a total embarrassment for the United States of America. They're just rubbing our noses in defeat. We're desperate to get out, and they know it. And now here we are. We're negotiating with terrorists. In 2003, this is early on in the war against terrorism, my father talked about President Bush. He was the president at the time, the prime minister here in the UK, Tony Blair. And he said how that they courageously restricted Iran's influence by toppling the governments of Afghanistan and Iraq. However, here's what my father said. However, these are ongoing terrorist wars. They're not over. We will still lose those wars if our nations don't unite behind our leaders. And he says that is almost certainly not going to happen. There's not going to be unity. We won't persevere until the end in this war. At some point, we'll cut our losses and go. We'll flee. We'll withdraw. We're seeing it happen now. My father said Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush had the vision to see that our nations can't win the war against terrorism without using our power. Most of our politicians and press and our universities do not understand terrorism, nor do they understand history. He talks about how misinformed we are, how that we don't know our history. And he says, finally, superpowers cannot survive in this evil, warring world without the will to wage long, hard wars. We just don't have the will to follow through. It's been a waste. $1 trillion and 2,000 lives. And now, right here at the end, we get to sit across the negotiating table with five top Taliban chiefs that fought and killed Americans and others in the Middle East. Superpowers cannot survive in this evil, warring world without the will to wage long, hard wars. It says this is the real world in which we live. Fantasies won't change that reality. Here is America, the great superpower of the world, and we can't even defeat, like Mr. Armstrong said, Herbert Armstrong in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, we can't even beat little Vietnam. And so he said in that same book, the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, the United States has won its last war. How could he make such a bold claim? When did he write that? Back in the 1960s or the 1950s, maybe? How could he know the U.S. has won its last war? He knew because of those verses in Leviticus 26. God said, I'll break the pride of your power. God said, your strength shall be spent in vain. If, it says there in that same passage, if you walk contrary unto me and will not hearken unto me. We're seeing these prophecies being fulfilled right in front of our faces, right across from the negotiating table, just on the other side of the negotiating table, prophecy being fulfilled. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
We want to get to some breaking news right now. NBC News exclusive reporting on the Senate Intelligence Committee, their investigation into Russian election interference and what they have and have not uncovered. NBC's Ken Delanian has just jumped in front of a camera to join me with his new reporting. So, Ken, what are you hearing? What are you learning?
Hallie, after 2 years and interviewing more than 200 witnesses, the Senate Intelligence Committee has not uncovered any direct evidence of a conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia. That's according to sources on both the Republican and the Democratic side of the aisle, Hallie. And careful viewers and readers will note that Senator Richard Burr, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee who leads this probe, essentially said that in an interview with another network last week. But what I've been doing since then is checking with my sources on the Democratic side to understand the full context of his remarks, because that was essentially a partisan comment from one side. But this is a bipartisan investigation, and what I found is that the Democrats don't dispute that characterization.
So Republicans came out last week and said, no conspiracy here, no collusion here. And now MSNBC discovers that it's bipartisan. The Democrats agree. So here's some breaking news, and of all places, it's on MSNBC. And President Trump was quick to thank them. How many times does he thank MSNBC? Thanks, MSNBC. The Democrats don't dispute it. There's no evidence. And it's been going on for 2 years. 200 interviews. No evidence of collusion. Now, the written report of this, this is from NBC as well. It says, by many counts, Trump and his associates had more than 100 contacts with Russians before the January 2017 presidential inauguration. Now that, just that alone, makes it's suspicious. It's suspicious activity. The fact that there was any kind of a contact with a Russian, if it was the other side, of course, contacts. Well, John Brennan himself, he voted for communists in 1976. Right here in the United States, or right in the United States. Hillary Clinton, I'll get to an article later, she had all that contact with the Russians, approving of the United States offloading so much of its uranium. All of those Russian oligarchs, the reset with Russia, Bill Clinton getting paid off by some of those rich Russians, speaking over in Russia, even as the State Department headed up by Hillary Clinton. It was Obama's State Department, all of these individuals involved in these sweet deals for Russians, for Vladimir Putin. But here comes Donald Trump. And, of course, the standards automatically change. 2 years. No evidence. No evidence of any kind of a conspiracy. This is Molly Hemingway. She is editor, the editor at The Federalist, which we quote from quite often. But here's what she said last night on Fox, clip two.
Every day or every couple of days for 2 years, we've had this Russia collusion conspiracy spread and pushed by compliant people in the media. No matter how small an item was, it was pushed as evidence of some grand conspiracy. Then you have the Senate Intel Committee coming out and saying what the House Intel Committee already said. There's no evidence of collusion. There's no evidence of this thing that sidelined an incoming administration, that completely took the Attorney General out of commission until he was finally let go. That, you know, you had just all of this hysteria, and we're not even going to cover it, or we're not going to mention it after pushing this story for several years. It's one thing for Democrats to push this. It's entirely another for people in the media to be so much going along with it. It's also something where we still aren't dealing with the fact that the intel community completely took in this information operation that was bought and paid for by Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. And they used this information to spy on a presidential campaign, to punish people for the crime of having not wanted Hillary Clinton elected president, or to put people in prison because they had the wrong political alliances. This is so deeply un-American. We are not supposed to do things this way.
That's Molly Hemingway yesterday on Fox News. 2 years it's gone on. Now we get to the end of it. I guess Bob Mueller's report is supposed to come out any time. And that will probably verify these reports coming out of the House and the Senate. No evidence. You would think there would be quite a few people in the media that would really be doing some deep soul-searching right about now. that would go back over what they've been saying for 2 years, as Hemingway just brought out. All it took over the past 2 years was just a tiny item, anything, and they would push it out there as evidence of this grand conspiracy. Collusion with Vladimir Putin. It's all that we've been hearing. And as she brings out, it's deeply un-American. And she exposes, too. She exposes the plot, really. The intel community taking that Steele dossier and running with it. Using it to get search warrants. Using it to get warrants for spying. So here comes this report. And as you just heard from MSNBC, there's no evidence. And so, of course, the major media, they're out there in full force last night, all day yesterday, to say that, well, yeah, no evidence, but he's still a secret Russian agent. So John Brennan, he is at MSNBC? Yeah, I think he's with MSNBC. He's the CIA director under President Obama. These reports come in, no evidence. And yet, here's what he says last night on cable news, clip 3.
Now. There's collusion in plain sight. Donald Trump at the end of July openly called on Russian intelligence to find Hillary Clinton's emails. There were engagements at the Trump Tower. There were the back and forth between various individuals who were affiliated with the Trump campaign and Russian individuals. That collusion, I think, is quite obvious and apparent. What the Mueller team is doing is trying to determine whether or not the engagement rises to the level of criminal conspiracy, whether they violated the law. You can collude without violating the law. And I know the Senate Intelligence Committee came out and said they found no direct evidence of criminal conspiracy, but that's not the Senate Intelligence Committee's remit. It is the FBI and a special counsel's team to do the criminal investigation.
And so what's he going to say when the Mueller report comes out? Now, I don't know what the Mueller report's going to say, but the point I'm making is nothing will satisfy them. You could get 1,000 reports that say there's no evidence of this. He's still guilty. And this is the former CIA director saying it's collusion in plain sight. How do we know? Well, because so many people in Trump's campaign have talked to a Russian before. As if that never goes on the other side. It's going on constantly. It's going on right now. Here he is, a former CIA director under President Obama. And in 1976, he voted for the Communist Party candidate in a U.S. election. He voted communist. And he had no problem later on in his career getting security clearance. He had no problem getting top secret clearance. So that he could head up the CIA for the United States of America. And he's on MSNBC yesterday saying that it's Donald Trump who has the problem with the Russian connection. Unbelievable. That man you just heard, he's primarily responsible for pushing the dossier. It was his department in December of 2016 who was responsible for saying that the Russians not only interfered, that's what they were saying leading up to the presidential election. It was the CIA that said, yeah, now we understand that they not only interfered, they interfered to help Donald Trump. That was John Brennan's agency. Out there running with the first line of the dossier. The Russian regime has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for at least 5 years. Oh yes, he was there pushing that, pushing the dossier narrative, pushing the intel report that they put together hastily in December of 2016. And they got together and talked about it in January 5th, 2017, just weeks before the inauguration, to plot against the incoming president of the United States. And for more than 2 years of searching, 2 years of searching to see if Michael Cohen was in Prague, to see if this nonsense happened in the Moscow or wherever it was hotel. 2 years to try to make all of these connections, and all that they can get are process crimes. And now the Senate comes out. The Senate, Republicans and Democrats. There's no evidence. Yeah, but wait. It's collusion in plain sight. Everyone knows. You just know. You don't need evidence. You just know. He was colluding, and so therefore it must have been a conspiracy. Here's what MSNBC, a panel on that station last night, had to say, clip four.
But the reality is criminals and other people conspiring don't put these things in writing. You have to infer it from the surrounding facts, from the emails, from the text messages.
Okay, so it's not in writing. You just have to make an inference. You read a few emails. You read the text messages. You look at any and every bit of circumstantial evidence that you can find, and then you infer. You infer. That's what the dossier does. That's what the dossier did in mid-2016. It started right off the bat with a whopper. The Russian regime has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for at least 5 years. Oh, where's the evidence of that? Well, we don't have evidence, but look. We're inferring that that happened. And that's good enough for MSNBC. MSNBC is the one that they broke the story that there's no evidence. And in the same day of coverage, breathlessly reported that, well, there's no direct evidence. But we have a lot. We have a lot that we can base a pretty strong supposition of guilt upon. We've inferred this because of all these emails on Chris Matthews' program. He talks about, well, what does this mean if there's no evidence, but Donald Trump somehow gets away with it? Gets away with what? If there's no evidence, what's he getting away with? Here's the way Chris Matthews put it, clip five.
Let's talk about how history will look at this moment. If Trump walks on this, there's no real strong Robert Mueller report that says that nearly nails him. But yet everybody has been following this case, who've watched this program and others like it. They've been following this case for like 2 years. They know all the pieces of it, and they know it's not all, coincidental. They know there's so much action here on both sides that it's hard to imagine in any other way that they were working together with the same goal, get Trump in there, get the Trump team to help Russia.
It's just obvious. It's just obvious that he was meant to get in there with Putin's help in order to help Russia. So what happens if at the end of the road, you've got the House intel report, you've got the Senate intel report, and then if the Mueller report comes out and nothing really nails him, what does this mean? If you've watched this program, he says, then you know, you just know. You know there was collusion. You know there was a conspiracy. What does this mean if he gets off scot-free? If he's able to walk away from this? Well, one of the guys on the panel there talking with him, listen to what he had to say in response to what Chris Matthews just said there. This is clip six.
But let me just say one thing. When Benedict Arnold gave the plans to West Point, to Major Andre, and they captured Major Andre, they did not have any real information linking those plans to Benedict Arnold, other than the fact that he was in his presence at one point during that day. But everyone knew it was treason when they caught the man and they hung him.
So there's your historical reference of record, a direct analogy. There was no direct evidence that Benedict Arnold was guilty, but everyone knew it was treason. Everyone knew he was guilty, and so he was executed. That's MSNBC last night. Isn't that nice? Saying that Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States, is Benedict Arnold. He's betraying America. He's undermining the Constitution. He's a traitor. His real goal, his real objective is to help Vladimir Putin. It's to help the Saudis. It's certainly not to help the American or the American worker. Everything he's doing, everything he's done since day one, it's a conspiracy. It's collusion. Well, but there's no evidence. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that there's no evidence. It doesn't matter that there's nothing to nail him directly. We know. We know. And if you've watched this program for 2 years, they say, then you know. You know he's guilty. And so here they are, even now, plotting their next move. Okay, if he gets off because there's no evidence, how can we take him down otherwise? Well, the wheels are already in motion on that front. Because we've got to look at his banking records, all of his business deals, his tax returns. We've got to look at obstruction of justice. There's so many other angles that we can go on here. And Adam Schiff has said as much. He's the one, by the way, who said he saw the evidence. Not just circumstantial. He saw it. Oh, yes. He said that over a year ago. And he's on NBC just over the weekend. And the reporter, that they don't ask him. They don't pin him down. They don't say, well, look, both houses now have come out and said there's no evidence. You said you saw the evidence. Where is it? No, he's moved on. He's moved on to all of these other areas where Donald Trump's children can be investigated, his business dealings, his tax returns. It's never ending. And meanwhile, you want to talk about collusion in plain sight, to use the words of John Brennan. John Solomon had a piece at The Hill a couple of days ago talking about the real case for Russian collusion. It's with the Democrats. Here there's no evidence that Donald Trump is guilty of this Democrat-inspired allegation that he colluded with Vladimir Putin. And yet you look at the other side. Here's what Solomon said, a donor to the Clinton Foundation. Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg led the Russian side of the effort and several American donors to the Clinton charity. It says Clinton's State Department, this goes back a few years, she's the Secretary of State. And she's negotiating all these deals with Russia, even as her husband is getting paid $500,000 for a speech by these Russian companies. It says the former president's trip secretly raised eyebrows inside his wife's State Department internal email show. Even the internal, you want to talk about inference? Here are emails in the State Department saying, former President Bill Clinton's over in Russia and he's getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it comes right at the time when it's going to be Hillary Clinton signing off on this Uranium One deal, where Russia gets all the uranium and the Clinton Foundation gets all the cash. It says that's because he asked permission to meet Vekselberg, the head of Skolkovo, and Arkady Dvorkovich, a senior official of Rosatom, the Russian nuclear giant, seeking state's permission to buy Uranium One, a Canadian company with massive U.S. uranium reserves. No collusion here. No conspiracy, no criminal conspiracy, no nothing. How many? They mentioned 100 contacts with Russians during the presidential election campaign of Donald Trump. How many hundreds of contacts do you suppose are here with Rosatom, with Putin, with the Kremlin? It says years later, it was going on right in plain view, so much so that internal emails at the State Department said, well, hang on, is this okay? Can this be done? Solomon says years later, intelligence documents show both the Skolkovo and Uranium One projects raised serious security concerns. In 2013, the U.S. military's leading intelligence think tank in Europe sounded alarm that the Skolkovo project might be a front for economic and military espionage. A year later, the FBI went further and sent letters warning several U.S. technology companies that had become entangled with Skolkovo and the risked possible espionage. And an agent in the Bureau's Boston office wrote an extraordinary op-ed to publicize the alarm. They were trying to sound the alarm. These are the companies that Hillary Clinton's State Department is working with, and we're trying to hand over the U.S. uranium stockpiles to Vladimir Putin, of all people. It says Skolkovo may be a means for the Russian government to access our nation's sensitive or classified research development facilities and dual-use technologies with military and commercial application. That's that op-ed written by the FBI agent. Going back to 2013, it says the FBI had equal concern about Rosatom's acquisition of Uranium One. Oh, they were concerned back then. This is long before President Trump ever came along. And even the Obama FBI, was startled by what was going on. It says the evidence shows the Clintons financially benefited from Russia personally and inside their charity. At the same time, they were involved in U.S. government actions that rewarded Moscow and increased U.S. security risks. What did MSNBC say about emails, contacts? And, well, they're not going to have it in plain writing, but you can infer a lot, you see. Look at these inferences. It says the intersections between the Clintons, the Democrats, and Russia carried into 2016 when a major political opposition research project designed to portray GOP rival Donald Trump as compromised by Moscow was launched by Clinton's presidential campaign and brought to the FBI. Based on all of these supposed Russian sources. Collusion, as John Brennan said, in plain view. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with that article about how that we need to, even if we're in an office environment, that we need to keep moving. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I might have mentioned this statement before when we were commenting on some of the material in John Adams, the John Adams biography by David McCullough. But I think he was writing to his son, maybe. Adams was known for taking long walks. I don't think anyone would say he was as fit as a fiddle, but he did like to get outside. He was outdoorsy, and back in his day, they were used to harder physical labor in their downtime. These were tremendous scholars. These were men that could sit at their desks, I'm sure, for hours upon hours and hours. Incredible speakers and writers, but also considerably more active than we are today. so many of us settling into a more sedentary lifestyle. But John Adams, in talking to his son, he said, move or die. Move or die is the language of our Maker in the constitution of our bodies. God intended, in other words, God intended for our bodies to move. And if you don't move them, particularly as you get older, and I think some of us can attest to this, if you don't move them enough, things begin to really break down. The body really begins to slow down. So this article, this is actually at The Guardian, it talks about how that a few years ago it was saying it's dangerous to just sit all through the day. And so they recommended a few years ago to stand more, to engage some of your leg muscles. Excessive sitting is a lethal activity, the New York Times concluded in 2011. And so the solution, or at least the ones that people got from that study years ago, was to stand more. But this piece here at The Guardian says it's not the furniture that makes the difference. In other words, it's not just the standing desk. It's the behavior. The desk without the behavior doesn't help you. It says, in fact, according to the findings of a 2015 consensus panel on the topic, we need to be on our feet 2 to 4 hours while at work. But the real solution is to move all day. The stillness is what's killing us. We should be pacing the hallways and climbing stairs and squatting and lunging and stretching. And the great thing about this, and again, this article is very corrective for me, but the great thing about it is there's this practical schedule that it includes at the end of the article. Here's what you can do. If you're like me, you get to the end of, well, like say with radio, you get to the end of a radio broadcast, you're a little bit out of it, and you feel like, well, mentally, I just want to veg or sit down for a 20 or 30 minutes to kind of regather my steam, my strength to finish the day. And you think about, well, exercise would be good, but then to take off the suit and go outside, you start sweating, and then you've got to clean up, put the suit back on. But this article goes through just little things that you can do through the day, like wall sits or some push-ups, 20 push-ups over lunch, things that you could do even in your dress clothes, that if you spread it out over the course of a day, maybe stretch out that walk to the coffee machine or that lunch break around the headquarters complex, just to get some fresh air. Some really helpful techniques. I didn't actually bring those with me, the last part of the article, but maybe I can point some of those suggestions out on tomorrow's show or later on. But the article, I'll just focus on that for now. It says, this is especially true if, like me, you exercise vigorously each day and therefore consider yourself healthy. Researchers have shattered that idea. I might run for an hour every weekday morning, but studies show that if I then go to work and sit at my desk for epic stretches, which I do, I am no more immune to the side effects of sedentary living than the prototypical couch potato. So, not to overwhelm you that you've got to do this, 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 and this now. If you're running in the morning, good for you. That's better than nothing. But his point is that even if you have that daily workout in place, firmly fixed into the schedule, try to incorporate more movement into your routine at work. More movement. He says, I placed a sticky note on my office door that said, farther, a little prompt reminding to use the facility most distant from me every time I needed a drink or a bathroom break. I also connected my computer to the printer downstairs and across the building. This makes me feel bad because I have my son run and get my printout. If I do print to the one upstairs. But he says, and rather than sending emails or using the phone, I tried to go directly to colleagues' offices. Of course, there's some benefit there just with respect to face-to-face time with people, instead of just always leaving it for an email. It says, finally, if I continue to squeeze in an extra hour or two of movement each day, I'll be significantly healthier in the long run. That's the takeaway Levine and his colleagues need us to hear. He says, if you want to dedicate yourself to a lifetime of good habits. Don't start at the gym. Start at the office. That's from the Guardian by Christopher Keyes, saying, forget standing desks. To stay healthy, you've got to move all day. You've got to move. Well, we've had some articles at thetrumpet.com. Joel Hilliker had a piece, Don't Just Sit There. That was from August 2014. And then another one, Jörg Mardian, Cross Train Your Brain. That's from July 2016. And, of course, if you go back before that, Herbert Armstrong, a very balanced perspective on good health, as you know from the New Testament. God says, above all, I want you to prosper and to be in health, even as your soul prospers. Jesus said, I'm come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. God's will is for us to lead a life of quality in every respect, including that of physical health. That's why he's outlined very definite laws of health within the pages of his inspired word, the Holy Bible. Work harder. I know I need to. Work harder at obeying these practical health laws today, whether it's exercise or eating right or fresh air, sunlight, whatever it is. And enjoy the wonderful benefits of a robust and healthy physical life. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.